Hi, it's Susan, and I'm an expert in helping musicians to have better relationships with themselves and with the world. In this episode, we meet Ralph Bathurst, violist and academic. Ralph's had a fascinating journey, just you wait to hear it unfold. And he shares a deeply spiritual and philosophical view of his journey as a performer through his work in music, in organized religion, and in academia. Enjoy. Welcome to today's episode of the Change Your Tune podcast. I'm your host, Susan Eldridge, and I'm delighted to welcome our guest today, lecturer in management and leadership, Ralph Bathurst. Ralph, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Where are you joining us from today, Ralph?
I'm in Auckland, just outside the city fringe in a place called Orewa, which is probably close enough to paradise. Has the best beach in the world and maybe not the best cafes, but certainly the best lifestyle.
Maybe one of these days when we can travel again, we'll all come and enjoy the delights of your neighbourhood in Auckland.
Well, you would pass through it. You may not want to stay, though.
Ralph, can you tell us about your work as an academic and a lecturer in management and leadership?
Sure. So I'm a late starter in academia. I have been working at the university I'm at now, Massey University, for the last 20 years. And this is my first academic job. So I'm kind of a late developer, if you will, in this industry. So although I lecture in management and leadership, which are two separate elements, I bring an arts-based approach to those subjects. So I work in quite a hardcore business school, but students find that my approach is quite different from the normal studies that they would do in a business school. So I try and link the practice of music making and art making, music appreciation and art appreciation into the study of managing and leading. If that makes some sense.
It does. And can you tell me a little bit more? So you said the students appreciate the different perspective that you bring. Is that in the way that you teach and in the relationship that you have with them as a teacher, or is it in the eyes that you bring from your arts background?
I would say the former rather than the latter. I think students value a personal touch, and I try and build relationships with them from the outset of the programs. Just also by way of background, most of the students I work with are internationals. So most of those internationals come from mainland China. So I try and link my ideas to at least ancient Chinese philosophies and try to position music in particular as an important element of social well-being that the ancient Chinese understood, and that we've kind of in our societies lost touch with, both in contemporary China and in our own country in New Zealand. So the practice of music making opens up the possibilities of exploring formal arrangements of how music is constructed, and that then links well into how organizations function as temporal, ephemeral phenomena that are slippery to define. But music enables me to get to those definitional problems, if you will. I'm being a bit esoteric now, but you might ask me some other questions about that.
I certainly will ask you some more questions. Hit on a really good point there is that the way that we approach the world as trained musicians helps us think in a way that enables us to both grapple with complexity and concepts that are very, as you said, ephemeral. So it's the way of being able to hold those two things of how do I dig into the emotion of the piano concerto I'm playing, but I need to be extremely atomically level focused attention to detail on things. So it's mm-hmm.
it's a beautiful way of training the brain. So Ralph, before you said this is your first academic appointment currently at Massey University. What were you doing before you were lecturing in management and leadership?
Well, I've been doing a number of things. I've got my career has been, as the word suggests, careering all over the place, or careening all over the place. So immediately prior to being a lecturer, I was a career counsellor in a high school. And that's what got me into academia, I guess. I fell into career counselling because I wanted a job closer to my home. And I was a music teacher prior to that, about 1 hour's drive from my residence. So a job came up at the local school in the neighbourhood where I lived. And so I applied for it and got it. And then after getting it, proceeded on training for career counselling. And then during those studies, I got very interested in formalising my interest in organisations. So I studied a master's at Auckland University in management, basically to become a better career counsellor, but in the process became very fascinated with the aesthetics of organising. And so that's after I finished my master's, I took up a PhD study with my supervisor then, David Barry, who had moved to Victoria University in Wellington. And so my PhD got closer to the music organising interface, and I'd carried out my research on the Auckland Philharmonia that was going through a governance change at the time, where they moved from one extreme as a cooperative to another extreme as a corporately managed and corporately led enterprise. So that became fascinating to me, why they would renounce their cooperative ideals and flip. And so my PhD study was really an ethnography of that, but bringing in musical dynamics and an understanding of the orchestra from this organizational perspective.
It's such a fabulous petri dish of everything, isn't it? People are messy, fascinating, unpredictable beings. Mm. No more so than in the microsystem of an orchestra. Yeah. All its functions. So, before you were, did you train, Ralph? Did you train to be a music educator? Is that what your original?
Yes. So when I started out. Yeah, I was studying music at Canterbury University and completed my Bachelor of Music in Music Education and my Diploma of Music in Viola Performance. I studied music education because that was the only program that offered conducting as a course. So I kind of accidentally fell into music education just for perfunctory reasons. So my first job was a high school music teacher in Christchurch, which I stayed in for 4 years. And at the same time, I was playing viola in the Christchurch Symphony Orchestra, which at then was a part-time professional job. So it wasn't enough to support a full-time career. But so I was music teaching and music playing in the orchestra and teaching privately music as well, viola and violin at home, and Saturday morning music school for young people in the Christchurch area. So that lasted for about 4 years. Then I had a complete change and became a minister for 10 years. And that took me into a completely different area of work, as you can imagine.
I'm astounded. That was a part of your story that I wasn't aware of. But what was the? Can you share a little bit more about that decision? From I guess you'd had an idea in mind of what your working life would be like, which is in music and in teaching and performing, and you'd achieved that. So what was missing? How did you get to become a professor?
It gets complicated, so I hope you're
helpful. I'll grab a piece of paper, I'll make a map.
Yeah. So, I only had ever two ambitions. One was to be a conductor, and the other was to be a minister. So I reached a critical point in my life where I was a music teacher and conducting youth orchestras and ensembles, and had in mind that I might study conducting more formally, while at the same time had this other interest in Christian ministry. So I had decided to go back to university and study postgraduate work, and then, if possible, go overseas and study conducting. At exactly that same time, a position came up in a rural church where I was invited to be the pastor. So I took that opportunity, basically. To cut a long story shorter.
Oh, it's absolutely fascinating. We would love to dig a little bit deeper. So what was happening inside your inside your brain in terms of the way that you thought, the self-identity that you had constructed about the pursuing conducting professionally, ending up teaching and performing, and then that change to become a minister. I'm interested in the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are and what we're doing in that transition journey. So what was going on there for you at the time?
So I wouldn't have used that language back then. I might now talk about my self-identity and how I construct myself. I wouldn't have used those words. I think looking back, although it's been quite a, my journey's been quite confusing, I guess, or disparate, to come back to your agenda, I think I've always been a performer, and in whatever element of my life I've chosen to pursue, it's come back to performance. So for better or worse, I understood Christian ministry as a performance role. I understand teaching and lecturing to be similar, a performing role. So I've always been a performer and will till the day I die. And that would be the overarching construct, if you wanted, my self-talk, that this is what builds coherence in my own professional life.
And it sounds, it completely makes sense. And I think also on top of that is this notion of service. That's what we do as educators and teachers, we serve. And obviously in your role as a Christian minister, that's what you're doing as well. So performance and service seems to be a very strong theme as well.
You might say, but I wouldn't have said that. I struggle with that even till today. So I understand teaching and lecturing at whatever age to be a service. I do understand that. I struggle to fulfill that because the complexities of educating young people and adults bring constant contradictions. So an assignment is late or a student doesn't perform to expectations. I talk to myself and say, Ralph, you are the servant of this student, so you ought to man up and deal with the complexities. I would rather say just get over yourself to the student and buckle up and do the job. But I'm constantly having to remind myself that I'm in a position of authority. They're having struggles. I need to somehow come to terms with them and to approach them at their level of need rather than my wish for them to be perfect. I understand that it sounds like service would be prominent, though maybe that's just something that happens rather than being a deliberate choice.
Mm.
I don't know. Do you understand that?
I do understand. And it's also challenging in the confines of tradition, of any sort of traditional education model, is there's what you're ticking the damn boxes versus creating a learning environment for the students to fail and grow and connect with and all of this stuff that particularly is so you know, it's the glue, it's the space between people, whether that's on stage or in the teaching space or wherever we are, it's that space between two people where magic happens. And so how do we prioritize that? Because the content that we teach them might be irrelevant in 2 years' time, or you know, so that I find the same thing in my teaching is how do I stay true to serve their development as humans, that they can be flexible with whatever content or context they're going to go into, because it's unknown what that's going to be.
I could tell a story.
Please.
happened recently to me. So I'm teaching this postgraduate class, management class, and one of the students submitted an assignment, and the topic was about dialogue and opening space for inviting people to, how would you invite people into conversation so that you can manage better or something. And the student wrote something like, jazz musicians are freer because they can improvise without restriction. And she mentioned the as opposed to the Bach D minor fugue, I've forgotten that, 5-4-5 or something like that. So I wrote back to her and said, it's all good, you know, you're on to something here, but you're misguided, because jazz musicians also perform according to given structures and ideals. So I said, I'm giving you some homework. There's two restrictions. One, you can't say you can't do it. And two, you can't be sick next week, because I want you to tell us the answer to this homework. So the homework was to have her listen to the ending of the Bach piece in its original form on organ, and to do the same with the Jacques Lussier Trio's version of it. So she went away, she agreed to both conditions and came back and said, they're different, but she's waffling around in her language. And so first, this poses a problem to me, because most people are uneducated musically, so they have no lexicon with which to describe what occurs. And that bothers me, because music is so fundamental to our ways in the world. We hear it all around us constantly in restaurants and places that we go in the public domain. So we have a music world that's around us, but we have an uneducated populace to be able to deal with it. Anyway, back to the story is that the Jacques Lussier Trio add one final note, or before the final chord, the pianist, Jacques Lussier himself, changes Bach's intention. So Bach ends with a plagal cadence. He continues the ambiguity of his work right to the end. Jacques Lussier clears it up, cleans it up, adds an A bass, which creates a perfect cadence, or an A13 chord, which finishes the work. And I think, why are you lacking courage to, why do you have to fix something that's ambiguous? So I tried to describe this to the class. I don't think they got it, but it was a moment of inspiration to me in any case, that this contradiction between our world that's complex and uncertain and ambiguous, which Bach seems to describe to us, and the need for modernity to straighten the lines and to clean it all up so that it's clear and simplified and straight, if you will. So for me, it's a clear description of how modernity has messed with our world and how managers have this overarching need to simplify and to reduce complexity to the point where it's banal, actually. I don't think Jacques Lussier is banal, but I still wonder, why did he add that A chord? It's just one note, but it changes the intent of the work completely. So that came out of just a student writing something, and I took the moment and said, okay, let's take a look at this. She had written something, incidentally, in her previous assignment about Berlioz, who's someone I know a lot about, and gave her a task also on that instance to look at a Berlioz performance of Harold in Italy, and we discussed that as well. It had nothing to do with the program, but everything, if you will.
And I think you've touched on a really important point there, Ralph, that not only is valuable for the sector, as in the classical music sector, but just humans, is this the inability or the unwillingness we have to sit in discomfort and ambiguity. Mm-hmm. Our need to make order of the world. And so, I mean, we're hard to see patterns, like, you know, and music giving us a way to experience sitting in uncertainty. And I think that's one thing in the sector I see going forward, is these conversations and people not having the language around their emotions to express these feelings as well. Like, I'm a big fan of the work of Brené Brown, and she did this huge data set, and the average number of emotions that people can name that they have experienced in their life is 3. Mm. And those 3 emotions are sad, mad, and glad. not very nuanced, is it? And so how I sort of think often about how do we use. And you spoke about the general populace not having the level of music education that we do, and that's a correct statement. And I think perhaps, you know, a way that we could address that without requiring everyone in the world to be able to notate a playable cadence is simply use music as a mechanism to get people to express much more nuance in their emotion. So that your students could maybe explain on an emotional level the 2 different feelings of the jazz rearrangement of the Bach and the original Bach, as they may not have the language to talk about the music theory of what's happening, but they could talk about how it makes them feel. And I think that's a really crucial thing that I think is missing in the way that we educate musicians, is this real nuance around feelings and emotions, getting beyond bad, sad, mad, and glad, so that we can cope in a world that is uncertain.
I don't disagree with you, but I don't agree with you either. And that so, for example, in the first lecture I give to these postgraduate students on management, I show them the David painting, Jacques-Louis David painting of the Oath of Herati. So this is 2 sets of people with a father figure in the middle. And I warn the students from the outset, you know, I'm going to ask you to look at this painting. All the data that you need to know to interpret this painting is in front of your eyes. And without fail, students will generally say, well, it feels like, or it seems like, and they jump to judgment before analyzing what's directly in front of their eyes. So this is my problem with focusing on feelings, is that the information, the data that is before us, it remains unexamined. So if we don't have a lexicon to examine data, then it's my feelings which are legitimate and they're mine, and your feelings which are legitimate and yours, but we have no way of conversing about those unless we go back to, dare I say it, our hermeneutic abilities to be able to take complex data and work with it systematically so that we can observe what's going on in that work, if you get my drift.
Yeah, I do. And that's a really good point about that, the ability to unemotionally examine what is presented to us and also be able to then ask ourselves how that makes us feel.
Well, that's the thing, is that the better you know something, the more detail you bring to it, the more heightened your emotional response is. So knowing about something doesn't kill off emotion. It actually makes it more valid and perhaps more profound, if you will.
Yes, and also allows space in the conversation to say, oh, Ralph, I completely disagree with how you feel, that's the wrong way to put it. I have a completely different response. I feel completely different, but I absolutely see where your feelings would come from this very deep understanding of the source material in the first place. So it allows to exhibit great empathy and for two perhaps contrasting emotional states to exist together.
Well, yeah, indeed. And that's our problem in society, is that we tend to want to control people's responses. But if we were able to say, well, your emotions are your emotions, they're entirely valid and they're truthful to you. Let's talk about how we get to this point. So the problem is that we, again, don't have a language of conversation. And we go back to the performance issue, talking as a performance, so that you say something, I accept that, I add to that and pass it back to you, and together, as you've said, with that space that variates or is variable between us, we then construct together something that neither of us knew before.
Yes, and that's one of the things I've been pondering is what could, particularly in the divisive political environment that we're in, Australia's nowhere near where was going on in North America, but where there's the sort of who shouts the loudest and who has the most extreme view is a fundamental skill for us to be able to navigate conflict or to experience conflict and tension with others in an emotionally regulated way, so that we can both have two perspectives on the same story. It's like, what is the role that music could play in helping better civil discourse in politics? Yeah.
Well, funny you should mention that, because one of my current research projects is a piece that I'm writing titled Joshua Hawley Meets Igor Stravinsky. So I'm trying to get, you know Joshua Hawley?
No, tell me, please. He's new to me.
Well, you mentioned North American politics. He's the guy that stood outside on his way into Congress on January 6th.
Right,
with
got it. Yes.
Just upraised.
Yep.
So I had in mind that I wanted to do something about Igor Stravinsky because it's his 50th anniversary this year. And that picture plus an email from a colleague that suggested that Joshua Hawley was drawing on stuff from a early monk, 4th century, 5th century monk, Pelagius. And so that got me on this journey. But where am I going with this? I would that Joshua Hawley would engage with Stravinsky because Stravinsky had this ability to hold multiple ideas and constructs together without needing to resolve them to a particular ideology, if you will, musically speaking. So I'm exploring the work, the Symphony of Psalms, and the fugue, in particular the second movement fugue. And I've had the misfortune to go and read a lot of Hawley's speeches and explore some of his ideas. And the problem is that the USA, more particularly, and Joshua Hawley are stuck in this, they're a caricature of the thing that they critique or the thing that they criticize. So Joshua Hawley himself is the embodiment of the thing that he is saying that we need to get out of. I'm not saying that very well, but you'd have to read the paper when I've written it to get there. But it's just banal. It's vacuous, intellectually dishonest and vacuous, their work and the work of his party right now. There's this inability to grapple with the complexities that someone like Igor Stravinsky or any musician would grapple with in their day-to-day lives. We've probably gone way off topic now, but
we've gone way off topic. It's interesting now because this is we have two adolescent sons, and they sit and roll their eyes at every parent-teacher interview, where when the teacher talks about their ability to self-regulate themselves, to support others, to sit in the discomfort of learning new concepts that are challenging for them and dig down deep and do the kind of psychological and emotional work that needs to be done to learn stuff, I just keep saying, well, it's of course because they're musicians. you can see the boys sitting there like, okay, when's she going to trot it out and say yes, it's music education. We have gone way astray, but it's been a fascinating conversation, Ralph, and I think it's a wonderful insight into how you think and how you see the world. Can we just super quick go back? So after your career teaching, you went into the ministry, and then just whiz us through sort of what happened. You were a Christian minister for 10 years, and then what came next?
Well, you could say midlife crisis, which seems to be carrying on. I don't know, just a typical, 40-year-old, things run out of steam and you think, why am I doing this? And what am I defending? What am I promoting? Just didn't seem relevant. So, and at the same time, relationship breakup. So it all comes together. And from that point, I had done what I set out in my life to do, the two ambitions that I had. And my life is only just beginning. So what do I do next? So the rest is just about taking another step. So someone said, Descartes was wrong when he said, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. He should have said, volvo ergo sum, I move, therefore I am. So I've found, just looking back, that nothing's been deliberate since those days. Everything is just another step, another movement in to respond to something that's occurring at the time. So I needed a job closer to home because I didn't want to drive in traffic. I took that step. I did my master's. I took that step guessing well, I had an agenda, and that was to meet people and to become a better career counsellor, but it shifted off to another direction. So I've stopped trying to figure out how to run my life, and instead I'm responding to the moment as best I can, without prejudging how that moment might play out. So things have got even more complicated, but and I'm still here, I'm breathing and I'm living. And I think for the first time in my life over the last few years, I feel like I've become fully human.
That's such a powerful statement, Ralph. Thank you for the trust and vulnerability and honesty that you've shared with us in that. And I think I know there's a lot of musicians who listen to this podcast who are trapped in their own minds. They're not really trapped, but they believe themselves to be trapped in the career model, in their workplace, that they have a set of skills that are only useful in a very niche area. And your words about I move, therefore I am, and I just, all I, you know, and that ties in beautifully with the statement about having an agenda, which having been purpose-driven rather than process-driven rather than product-driven. I'm not sure where this is going to go, but all I need to do is take it forwards. And I hope that would be a balm for anyone listening who is on this journey of starting to unlock themselves from their own mind and free themselves from their own thinking, because it's what I'm hearing from you is that's what part of your journey has been, is in knowing yourself better. So just in closing, Ralph, do you play your viola anymore?
Well, that's a good question. I should. So here's one of the problems that I've encountered, is that when I perform, if I'm in an orchestra, I tend to not like to listen to music, and I become quite disengaged from the art. When I don't perform, and even when I don't talk about, so sometimes I take my keyboard to class and show them stuff about stuff. I find that while students like the opportunity to learn something different and to know something different, I find that that I don't have the same relationship to music. It's hard to explain, but I find that I'm most alive with music when I'm not having to play it. So I jam on my keyboard regularly, just because. So for example, I'm trying to figure out Girlfriend Ipanema at the moment, and I had a light bulb moment with another class that I was, an undergraduate class that I was teaching. I wanted to play them the Girlfriend Ipanema because I was talking about right and left hemisphere of the brain, if there was such a thing, and acoustic space and ocular space. So I wanted to tell these students that that the guy should have given it up. The girl is useless. She can't see. She can't see her world. She can only look straight ahead and is not aware of her surroundings. So that was the message of the words, but the music itself is highly complex and full of dissonance. And I just love playing that song and feeling those major sevenths and flattened second chords and the contradictions between the G major and the A flat and the A minor. I just find that fabulous. So I get quite a kick out of just messing with chords, basically. And I'm happy to talk about them, but I find the rigors of performing shuts me down in a sense of my appreciation for music. I wish it didn't, but it seems to do that.
I have the same experience, Ralph. And interestingly, I have a new chamber ensemble. It's a double wind quintet we're launching in a couple of weeks. And I'm trying to see if I can have a different relationship with performing than I currently have. And I'm using the repertoire that we're playing. I don't have that much to play. And so I'm using this as a bit of an experiment to see if I can have the experience that I have when I'm making music, which is not the experience that I have when I'm performing, because this is a very low risk gig for me. There's not very much to play. I'm being super mindful and meta aware of what is the gap between how I feel when I'm playing and how I'm feeling in this moment of performance practice and rehearsals, and seeing if I can close that gap. So I'm having a little fun with my mind about seeing if I can shift that relationship, because I have the same relationship as you. I don't like performing, but I love making music with people. And
well, that's the other side, isn't it? That there's the social dynamic of that, and the communitarian element of music making. Nothing else in the world can replicate that.
Correct. Yeah. Ralph, it's been an absolute gift speaking to you today. Cool. And having an insight into your fascinating journey and the life that has had music weaving through it for the last half a century. I'll put any notes to anything we've discussed in the show notes, but all the very best for
Give
us a journey that sits ahead for you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, all good. Okay, Susan.
Hey, thanks for listening and for making it all the way to the end. If you've enjoyed this episode, then please help me share these stories by sharing this with others. You can post about it on your socials, on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, or you can leave me a rating and a review about this podcast. To catch all the latest from me, you can follow me on Facebook or Instagram at Notable Values. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next time.